Okay, is it on? So what I'm going to talk about is the black hole information loss paradox, which, since we've heard so much about it, I'll belabor some more. But really my point is that we can save unitarity, which is much beloved by the quantum information theorists and probably not cared about by the general relativists as much, but we can save it without strongly modifying general relativity, which is good because I don't know anything about general relativity. But basically, the resolution lies in one new idea from quantum information and in just understanding information itself correctly, which you get a lot of different answers about why people think there is a black hole information loss problem. And I want to argue that the information isn't lost and that really nobody said it was. So why do people think information is lost in a black hole? Well, there's kind of two main reasons. One is the Hawking radiation is thermal. Okay, so you know everybody says this, and I bandy it around, but it's hard to get a straight answer out of people exactly what they mean. So to me, what this means is one of two possible things, that when you have a black hole, and after a while a photon comes out, you can write down the density matrix corresponding to this emission, and people say, okay, this is rho, and it's thermal. To oversimplify it, you know, it's just some density matrix that's maybe diagonal and has an entropy. Okay. But what happens if two photons come out? Which will happen sooner or later. Well, then you get rho squared. And after a while, you know, n photons come out, maybe the black hole has shrunk, and you have all sorts of light coming out. And, I mean, the precise statement of it being thermal would be that the whole thing is rho to the n. But really all you know, I think, is that if I trace out n minus 1 degrees of freedom of the sort of the big rho that comes out of this thing, that the small thing left is the same rho from before. And this is because each rho that comes out isn't perfectly thermal. Depending on how you interpret the semi-classical Hawking calculation, it's really, there could be a small correction. And for a cosmologically sized black hole, it'll be a very small correction. The sort of unit-based argument is the correction should be something like the size, the mass of the photon, maybe I wrote this too small, but it's a photon, it's small, divided by, you know, the mass of the black hole. And you say, okay, well, this is a very, very, very small correction by any standard. Except that if I wait around...
The mass of the photon is zero, which is...
Well, it's energy kind of mass, okay. You know. Yeah, I'm being imprecise, but okay. The amount of mass that the black hole loses is what I really should put there. So this is a very small correction. However, if I these corrections add up, when I go to the nth power, when n photons have left, well, the corrections, you know, if I have something that has, well, let's say the fidelity to the thermal state is 1 minus epsilon for this teeny little epsilon, and I take this to the n power, so it's 1 minus n epsilon. I get to multiply by n. But what's n? N is how many photons come out of the black hole when it's lost, say, 90% of its mass. Well, how many photons is that? Well, that's 90% of the mass divided by the mass of the photon. So all these things cancel out, and you get a correction here of order 1. And if you buy that, it means that the thermal radiation that's come out of this can very easily look thermal piecewise, but the whole thing looks nothing at all like a thermal distribution and indeed could have very low entropy or be anything at all that you want. So you only have to accept that the original Hawking semi-classical calculation is really any correction at all of a very reasonable size to say, okay, that the entropy that comes out is all accounted for. And it's just the same as when people talk about the encyclopedia getting chucked into the black hole and evaporating out. If I light that encyclopedia on fire, you know, everybody says, oh, what comes out is thermal at this nice temperature of the fire. But nobody says it's non-unitary.
So and what is the source of this correction in the original Hawking calculation? I'm just not familiar with it.
Well, you get all sorts of different answers depending on which general relativist you ask. But the main thing is that the it's considered like the black hole is unchanging, and really it shrinks a little, and it could pick up some momentum. Yeah, it's a back reaction of just really any reasonable sort should get some sort of correction. And that's almost, you know, you don't even need a quantum gravity to say that. I sort of feel like I've dispensed with this, and you get arguments about this, but at least it's plausible. Now, I've done too much theory lately, and worse, too much interpretations of quantum mechanics, so this actually suggests an experimental program, if anybody has any funding. And the experimental program is the following. You create some zero-temperature flat space, and then you put a lot of mass into it in a pure state. And you create a black hole, and you wait around for it to evaporate 90% of the way, and you collect all the radiation, and then you do a measurement with rank 1 POVMs on this. And that gives you a tomographic way of finding out what the state is and whether it's thermal or not. Now, of course, you have to do this many times. You have to do an ensemble of these things. So you need to make probably something like, you know, I have to do this many, many times. And the number of times you probably have to do is something like this order, which would be a difficult experimental program, but plausible. So basically, if there's any funding at all, I need all of it.
Also, the black hole rights people would probably go and try to liberate your black holes.
Well, that's right. I'm exploiting the black holes. Well, all right. There's nothing much I can do about that. I mean, they're not cute, right? I mean, only hairy animals are cute. So yeah, there's really no constituency. All right. So when I was talking, I think to John Preskill, but I forget exactly who said this at this point, I said, okay, well, the other reason, or another reason, we don't like unitarity for the black hole, and we say the information is lost, is because of causality. Because there's an event horizon, if I drop information into it, it better not come out. And the only time that it can come out without violating causality is when the black hole is evaporated down to this tiny little sort of Planck-sized thing, and then you say, well, okay, then quantum gravity for sure is going to dominate. But what we'd like is that no information comes out at all until that point. And then the argument goes, okay, I had a big black hole, it evaporated for a while into a little black hole, and you know, a field of radiation around it, and it seems unreasonable to say, well, there's no information in this field, sort of information, which I don't want to define yet, is kind of roughly zero, and then the information in here is all the information that you dropped into it. So this is much, much greater than zero. This may be a bad scaling constant. There's a whole lot of information in here, and this is independent of how big the black hole started out. That eventually you get down to this kind of small core, and it needs a lot of information. So the information density goes to infinity as the size of the initial black hole goes up, and people don't like that because, you know, it violates the holographic principle, and it also just seems unreasonable. So this is where this new result from quantum information theory comes in, which basically says, or the point of it is that you can have a lot of stuff having come out and very little entropy left in the black hole, and yet the stuff that comes out won't have any information in it about what was dropped into the black hole. And this is counterintuitive because it violates sort of a fundamental tenet of classical information. So classically, if I have two people and they have a classical random variable, x for one of them and y for the other one, I can calculate the mutual information that they have. I just say I of x and y. And then suppose somebody sends a small amount of information, say 1 bit, from x to y. Well, classically, I can say, well, what's the new information after I've done this? Well, that's always just the old information plus 1. Well, it's bounded by that. So if I send you 1 bit, your mutual information with me increases by 1 bit or less. If I sent you a bit you already knew, it would increase by less. Well, okay, that's kind of fundamental classically, and indeed mutual information is defined so this will happen. But quantum mechanically, can I use this board? Where did I put the eraser? Too much information. So quantum mechanically, what you have to talk about is that I have a density matrix shared between two people, and the mutual information I want to define is a thing called the accessible information. And the accessible information is the maximum over all measurements for that have a tensor product structure. So the two people that share the density matrix do these measurements separately, which lead to classical variables x and y of the mutual information between x and y. So you have a quantum state, you do the best measurement, and then see how much mutual information you have. It is a reasonable definition. And this thing violates this sort of arbitrarily badly. If I have a density matrix where the mutual information is some I zero, and then I send, let me write it like this, rho A B, and I send one bit from A to B, the mutual information I final minus I zero can be, let's say, it can be infinity. You can make it arbitrarily high. It's a function of the dimension of the Hilbert space you're talking about. So this is sort of surprising, but it's actually very simple to see how this can happen. So write down an example of this, which is a little less impressive, but gives you the basic idea. Suppose Alice and Bob share a quantum density matrix like the following. Bob has one of these four polarization states. So there's just four non-orthogonal states. They come in two orthogonal basis pairs. So Bob has this quantum state. And what Alice has is the classical information of which one of the four states Bob has. Very simple system. Well, you can calculate the mutual information between Alice and Bob. And it turns out that for the optimal measurement, this equals exactly one half of a bit. You think of this as Bob doesn't know the basis, so he picks one at random and measures it, and he gets the answer correctly half the time when he gets the right basis. So it comes out to half a bit. Now, if Alice, who knows the basis, just tells Bob, then the mutual information, well, Bob knows which basis to measure in, so he gets the bit correctly every time. And he also knows the bit that Alice sent him, which is the basis. So that's two bits. The bit that he measured and the bit that got sent. So we went from half a bit to two bits by Alice mailing him only one bit, which violates the classical thing already, although only by a tiny amount. Now you can generalize this and say, well, instead of four states in two dimensions, I can put two n states in n dimensions. And if I do that, I can just adjust this using exactly the same plan. There's still only two bases, but now there's two to the n states, and it goes from the initial information is half of the log of the dimension, and the final information is the log of the dimension plus one, which was the bit that was sent. And so here is an arbitrary increase in information by sending one bit. I went from some big number to some number twice as big. So the information, we call this unlocking of classical correlation or classical information. It went from one number to another number anomalously largely. And then it turns out that if you use a result from, what is it called, the random matrix theory, or this is a result from Winter and Hayden and who else is the authors? Yeah. Lung? Peter Shaw, of course, Peter Shaw. All right, so it's a result from Peter Shaw. And if you use that result, you can actually have a system where you start out with mutual information that's constant, so that it starts out at zero, and then you send some number of bits, which is something like log of the dimension of the space, And then the final mutual information is log of the dimension of the space. So I start out with essentially no information. This constant can be something like, you know, just 3. So I start out with 3 bits of information. I send a small amount of information, and I end up with an arbitrarily large amount of information. So let's find the picture of the small black hole again and say, okay, well, let's put inside of it this tiny amount of information, log log of n. And what's out here is this big Hilbert space of dimension n. And I can write down a state where the information in here is this tiny little thing, and the information which is has escaped is only 3 bits instead of this huge amount. And so I can avoid violating causality at least very much. I mean, 3 bits may be leaked out, but at least I didn't have dimension of log n bits leaking out. And this sort of rescues unitarity and without violating causality. I can wait around till the end and the information leaks out. Now, there's problems with this. This log log n has the unfortunate property, perhaps, that it depends on n. So I can still say that, well, the Planck scale should be some fixed size, and if I keep making my black hole bigger, it should have more and more information in it, and eventually I won't be able to, even this small core won't be enough to save causality. And that's a little disturbing, but there's sort of 2 escapes for that. One is, we don't know if this locking is optimal. Maybe you can make this grow even slower, although probably not a constant. And the other is to say, well, how big a black hole do I really have to worry about preserving unitarity over? This was a beautiful idea from, I think it was Karol Horodetsky, over dinner one day. And he says, well, okay, let's take all the mass of the universe, figure out the dimension of that Hilbert space and pretend it went into a black hole. And then say, well, how big a core do we need? So that core is, you know, something like log log the dimension of the universe. But 2 logs is, you know, got pretty small pretty quickly. And you say, okay, well, I'm just going to call that, you know, Planck scale. It defines it. So this suggests my second experimental proposal, which is count the mass very accurately of the universe and figure out how many dimensions of Hilbert space that corresponds to. And that tells you the Planck scale. But we also already know the Planck scale from other experimental evidence, and see if the number's the same. Either it is or it is. But the thing is that Planck scale is this very, very small number. And the mass of the universe is a very, very big number. So, okay, they're reciprocally related by this relation. Wouldn't that be nice? So, this is just a modest experiment that we should try to do.
But also the number of degrees of freedom in the universe and its maximum entropy depends upon the Planck scale. So you already put the Planck scale in there in order to calculate how many the dimension of the Hilbert space.
Oh, that may be true, yeah. All right, so this experiment is... Well, there's got to be some way to define this consistently, right?
Check on the
self-consistency. Anyway, so that's really the idea. What I don't want to suggest is that this solves everything, because it doesn't... well, I mean, I sort of feel like it does, but I'm not a general relativist, so I can't make these people happy, maybe. But its biggest flaw is that the states that do this locking are of a very particular form. And there's no mechanism proposed for why, when a black hole evaporates, it should make exactly these states, other than that if it did, it would preserve unitarity. And
good mechanism.
What?
That's a good mechanism.
Right, well, that's, well, I think that's a good mechanism, but it isn't really a mechanism so much as a reason. But really, my main point is that the arguments that people tell you for why unitarity fails, like the Hawking radiation is thermal, or the information can't leak out until the end, they don't really tell me that unitarity has failed. All they told me is that we don't know exactly what black holes are actually doing when they evaporate. But even in the semi-classical limit, I see no reason to just accept that my beloved unitarity has failed and I have to modify quantum mechanics to fix it, because, you know, there's really no evidence that it has. So that's all.
So you showed that the maximum accessible classical information between what went in and what out has this property. But, you know, somebody might say, like I'll just say it right now, that what you should really be looking at is the just bottom to five mutual information, trace rho A plus trace rho B, trace rho over log rho of A, no, entropy of A plus the entropy of B minus the entropy of A and B taken together. And then in that case, I don't think you get this property. Indeed, you know, one bit of quantum information, just by the same argument that in the classical case, can convey only one bit of quantum information.
That is true, but I don't think it's the right quantity to look at. I definitely don't claim to be able to lock information of that type. But really what you're talking about when you say causality isn't violated is not that somehow quantum information or even regular information leaks out. What you're saying is, can I predict the outcome of somebody's experiment before it happens? Right? That's what causality means. And if I start saying things like experiment, then I'm really talking classical information. And I don't know what it means to predict things in superposition, because then you end up predicting nothing except that everything happens in the many worlds. So you have to tie it down to an experiment at some point. Or at least, I prefer to tie it down to something that you can get a grip on at some point.
So I'm confused, because you proposed a tomographic experiment, and the tomographic experiment would actually give you the density from the outside. So I would seem to me that a...
Well, really all I want to do in the tomographic experiment is calculate the entropy that comes out and see if it's zero or high, to see how good the Hawking semiclassical calculation is. But that's really facetious, because I'm really starting out by assuming that everything is unitary, so I know what the answer is going to be before I do that.
He's counting on nobody doing that experiment.
Well, no, but if somebody does, I mean, it would be a very direct evidence of whether things are unitary or not. But, of course, it's basically impossible to do that experiment, so you have to drop back to theory. But even that experiment, it's tied to, you know, outcomes of detectors. Everything's macroscopic by the time it's done. Where I have some detectors, the tomography is I have a whole bunch of things, and I wait for a detector to click, and it clicks, and I write it down. Then I do the whole experiment again with many, many black holes. But experiments are always classical.
There's one question about these states. So I guess they are, I mean, you said they are very particular kind of states that have this property. So they're probably like a set of zero measure or something like that. So how would the black hole achieve that? I mean, for whatever initial condition, you end up in one of these states. That's not a unitary process then.
I don't think they are a set of measure zero, because the way you...
I don't know. I mean, I'm asking.
Well, I'm not exactly sure the answer to that, but I think they're not, because their whole construction is you take a random unitary matrix and apply it to your state, and that kind of encrypts it. And the random unitary matrix, you can choose ahead of time. You just choose from a set of random things where the total number in the set is log d, or log d.
Well, let's say, I wouldn't say measure zero. I mean, there are fewer than, I mean, most states will not have.
No, it actually says a set of measure one of these states will have this property. If you start with a random unitary matrix and you encode your state that way, then states that can be achieved by that are, by definition, a set of measure one. So,
yeah, I think it's okay.
Because it's a random state.
I have to think about the counting of this, but I do think it works out okay.
In St. John the Game, and our next.